This is ReachMD. Welcome to this special series, Changing the Conversation About Sickle Cell Disease, sponsored by Pfizer. Here is your host, Dr. Matt Bernholtz.
With sickle cell disease affecting close to 100,000 Americans, it's no wonder that more and more research is being dedicated to understanding this complex disorder. But what exactly has been uncovered, and how does that guide our therapeutic approaches moving forward? Welcome to Changing the Conversation About Sickle Cell Disease. I'm Dr. Matt Bernholtz, and joining me to discuss the latest updates in our understanding of sickle cell pathophysiology and treatment is Dr. Jason Wilson, Assistant Professor and Director of Clinical Research in the Division of Emergency Medicine at University of South Florida. Dr. Wilson, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I really appreciate being here.
It's great to have you with us. So to get us started, can you give us a quick primer on how sickle cell disease is traditionally portrayed from a pathophysiology perspective?
Sickle cell disease results from a genetic disorder. You have a hemoglobin SS that affects hemoglobin, which is the protein that carries oxygen around red blood cells. And because of that, you get an abnormally shaped red blood cell. Without access to medical care, humans with sickle cell disease live much shorter lives than those without disease or even those with the heterozygous trait. Patients eventually experience some pretty unfortunate emergent conditions, usually during an acute crisis, in which large volumes of sickled cells kind of clump together, block vasculature, and lead to end organ damage or even organ infarct. Most patients with sickle cell disease undergo things like a vascular necrosis, secondary to decreased delivery of oxygenated blood. So you get pain from vaso-occlusive crisis and from these other chronic things like a vascular necrosis. So unfortunately, even when these patients don't have an emergent medical condition, patients with sickle cell disease tend to suffer from daily small micro-occlusion events within the venous system that may be less threatening to end organs and may be less threatening to their overall mortality, but can still cause pain from disruption of normal blood return.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. That was an excellent rundown of how we perceive the disease pathophysiologically. What about any new insights about this disorder that may be changing the way we think about its development and progression throughout a patient's life?
Sure. One of the great things we see in developed countries is that patients who have access to medical care do have long adult lives, even meeting ages around 60 years old now. But the first and foremost cornerstone of sickle cell disease approach and management still lies within infection prevention and pain management. These are the key strategies, and those have not changed. While all sickle cell disease patients will have a concomitant anemia and a baseline low hemoglobin concentration, we really try to conserve transfusions to those patients who are in a hemolytic crisis, usually during a sequestration event, when they present with things like acute chest or other shock states. Most sickle cell disease patients will receive multiple red blood cell transfusions over their lives, and the adverse effects of all those transfusions are weighed against the benefits. As these patients survive more and more to adulthood, they've likely suffered splenic infarct already. They likely have a chronic avascular necrosis, chronic hip pain, joint pain, and even repeated small strokes, small cerebrovascular events. And many of those patients require daily pain control just to get through with daily activities of life. So with appropriate analgesia, we can try to control that baseline suffering and compensate with more analgesia during acute crisis. In the past, we kind of thought about objective criteria, the reticulocyte count, the heart rate, when we would evaluate the level of pain in the ED among sickle cell disease patients. But now we know that those objective criteria do not correspond really well at all to a patient's pain level when they have lived with that kind of pain with much of their life.
Why don't we then translate that into the signs and symptoms that we're looking for when patients with sickle cell disease present to the emergency department in the absence of having a truly representative or reliable objective criteria?
Right. So I think that's a great question. It's critical to where we are right now in this major paradigm shift in management of sickle cell disease patients. While the first thing we should still do anytime a patient comes in the emergency department, we should always think about the types of emergent medical conditions that patient has based on the probability of disease given their other diseases. So every sickle cell disease patient, every time they walk into an ED, has a risk for acute chest syndrome, splenic sequestration, hemolytic crisis, infection, shock, because of that other underlying immunocompromised. But once we rule that out, we have to focus on the fact that by probability alone, the patient's probably there because of pain. But I think the key out of this is that we now know that while laboratory values correlate very well to things like hemolytic crisis, laboratory values do not correlate very well to pain crises. And one of the complicating pieces of all of this is that a sickle cell disease patient who's lived into adulthood is going to develop a very complex pain syndrome because of their lifelong pain. And so what we really learned is that the only validated sign or symptom of a patient's pain level is a patient's subjective own assessment of their pain.
And so I think I'm getting a sense of where we're going with this then, but if patients, one sickle cell patient to the next, comes into your emergency department and shows very similar signs and symptoms that they're presenting to you, I take it that doesn't necessarily translate into having similar or even identical experiences of their pain.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, the one patient can look, you know, very, very comfortable with a high degree of pain. And another patient may report, you know, the same thing. Same with the visual analog scale. You know, a patient may report a 7 or a 5. If we don't know the patient's past history, what their own reports have been, it's very difficult to get at what that means to that patient. So every patient with sickle cell disease is different. And, you know, some of these patients, you look at the life cycle of their disease and their medical history, and they've really been able to manage their vaso-occlusive crisis with very little analgesia. While other patients require very high doses of opioids from an early, even adolescent or younger age. So we know that all patients, whether or not you have sickle cell disease or not, have really different responses to pain and pain management. So that's not that surprising if we really think about it. And then we certainly know that patients with complex pain syndromes have some very different subjective and objective responses to pain. So most sickle cell disease patients that survive to adolescence or further, they've really established a rhythm to the management of their disease, and they know their medication needs. And I think we have to hear their subjective assessments to just understand what they need.
Let's stay with pain management, since that's often the first and foremost complaint brought into your EDs. What steps do you take to address a patient's pain in this setting?
Well, for most ER docs and you know, other people working in emergency departments that see a lot of sickle cell disease patients, this will be the most complex type of pain management population that we deal with. We've joined a National Sickle Cell Disease Quality Initiative about a year and a half ago. And what we do is we share best practices with other emergency departments on a monthly basis that see high volume sickle cell disease patients. What we've learned, which was a little surprising, a little counterintuitive, I think, to all of us, is that the quicker we can provide the first dose of parenteral pain medication at the appropriate level, the less likely that patient is to require admission to the hospital, secondary to ongoing pain. And we tried something I think that has really worked very well for us. About 2 years ago, we started to really think about these patients as complex pain medicine patients who needed some aggressive pain control. And we established a patient-controlled analgesia program, or a PCA, which essentially enables patients to dose themselves with pain medication at predetermined levels while the entire time they're in the ED receiving a continuous infusion at baseline. The utilization of these PCAs has led us to having a pretty standard program across sickle cell disease patients where we don't have to guess what the patient's thinking, they don't have to guess what they're going to get, and everybody knows they're going to get some continuous infusion. And the education of just setting up the PCA itself has led to education about sickle cell disease for our nurses, for our providers, and really increased awareness of just how painful this syndrome is and, you know, just how significant the disease can be. So while it's a little counterintuitive at first, those larger doses of pain medicines and that more continuous steady state of levels of analgesia actually led us to decrease our admission rate for sickle cell disease patients by about 10 percentage points, meaning that, again, that patient likely receives less opioids and requires less pain medicine to resolve their acute pain crisis because we avoid that admission.
And I imagine alongside that trend towards standardized quality care protocols for pain management, your teams are also looking into standardizing a process for getting tests to make sure that nothing hidden may be going on behind the pain crisis itself. Is that correct?
That's correct. You know, our first duty in the emergency department is always to go back to thinking about what can hurt the patient now, what can kill the patient now, and thinking through those emergent medical conditions. So all of our patients with sickle cell disease are treated very seriously given the precancerous probability of a significant disease. A scoring system we use that predicts resources in the emergency department, it's called an EIS level. You know, 1 is you're essentially a code, 5 is you're there for a medication refill of your high blood pressure medicines. Most patients are a 3, the kind of in between. We determined a while ago that all of our sickle cell disease patients would get a 2, which would, you know, put them back in front of a provider much quicker and allow us to evaluate them without medical screening exam much more rapidly. And during that, we try to rule out emergency medical conditions. So given that, we simply have a lab protocol for all these patients. That all of them are going to have a hemoglobin tested. Fortunately, we have, with our population, hemoglobins usually from the past, so we can compare the current hemoglobin to look for evidence of things like sequestration crisis or acute hemolytic anemia that's worsening. you get a reticulocyte count on all of these patients. And then if there's chest pain or a difference in the chest pain or anything that seems abnormal there, we are aggressive about getting chest radiography and electrocardiograms in those patients with chest pain. And again, fortunately, most of our patients have been tested before, and we know some of our sickle cell disease patients, and we not only have our standardized order sets, we also take what they say very seriously. And if anything seems different than usual, we add, we become more aggressive in our ordering more quickly.
Maybe we can hone in on that a little bit more, because you mentioned the idea of physiological dependence and pain syndromes that develop for these patients as physiological consequences to requiring those high-dose pain management protocols over long periods of time and even lifetimes for these patients. Can you talk to us a little bit about that in more detail?
Sure. My residents and students that I work with often are surprised at how aggressive I am with these patients. And either they worry that, well, what if the patient is drug-seeking, or what if the patient isn't having a vaso-occlusive crisis and they're really here just because they have a dependence on drug? And I sort of usually point at them and they have a white cup with a green Little Mermaid picture on it, and they have to have that before they come into work. You know, they have their coffee. And I have my allergy medicine. I have allergic rhinitis. I have to have that before I go to work, plus my coffee or caffeine of some sort. And I point out that, we all have some physiological dependence on some drug, but the existence of that physiological dependence on drug does not necessarily mean there's a devious or manipulative reason or consequently, meaning behind that. So, a patient develops a complex pain syndrome and physiological dependence, that becomes kind of wrapped up in the overall disease itself. And I think we do a disservice to ourselves, and we probably spend too much time, or at least in the past, spent too much time trying to sort out, is this a vaso-occlusive crisis? Is there objective evidence this being a vaso-occlusive crisis? Or are they just in pain? Or do they just have a dependence on pain medication? I think we can take at face value, especially the patients we know well.
And I love your analogy there. I wanted to just, as my last question to you, get a sense of whether there are any current or future research directions in sickle cell treatment that you're particularly excited about for helping advance some of these perspectives that we talked about today.
Yeah, so I think while, the protection against infection and immune protection remain our cornerstone, along with pain medication and analgesia, the current treatment, I think part of what my role here is, and part of what I try to educate with sickle cell about, is, really just establishing those two things right now, because the paradigm for so long, we haven't really had any other breakthrough novel therapeutics. There really wasn't too much coming through with a kind of a different take or different perspective or different pathway to manage disease. But I will say one of the bright lights, one of the promising things that we're kind of starting to see some signals from is an area where medication attempts to prevent clumping and prevent even the vaso-occlusive crisis from happening. So while those therapeutic techniques are still very early in research stages, I think I'm starting to see some promising signals from that data regarding decreases in opioid utilization and decreases of the acute frequency of a vaso-occlusive crisis, which means that patients have to be in the ER less and spend less days in the hospital, less days of their life sitting, waiting for us to give pain medication. So I think in that, to actually see something show up in the landscape that's a little bit different and has a preventative role potentially in vaso-occlusive crisis is a really exciting place to be right now. And I'm really hopeful to see where that avenue takes us.
Well, those are definitely exciting insights into the latest developments in sickle cell disease research and treatment. Dr. Wilson, it was great having you on the program today. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, I had a great time. I love talking about this stuff, and I love to see our sickle cell disease patients get the best care possible.
The preceding program was sponsored by Pfizer. To revisit any part of this discussion and to access other episodes in this series, visit reachmd.com/sicklecellconversations. Thank you for listening.